Track C, building a security response process.
Morning Stalker, kind of remind me, I'm supposed to remind people, we have a conference in the October time frame. Y'all come. It's cheaper than this, it's 2 days longer than this. Okay, so much for the advertisement. This afternoon's talker is Scott Culp. He is a product engineer at Microsoft. He worries about Windows NT. He is the fingers, I love this one, on the keyboard at secure@microsoft.com. When you have a security problem and send a message, he is the one who receives it and addresses the issues. Scott?
Thanks, Jack. Good afternoon. I'm going to talk for, pardon me, I'll have to ask you to excuse me, I'm getting over a little bit of a cold, so if I sound like Barry White, that's why. I'm going to talk for about 40 minutes about the process of building a security response process for your company's products. I'm going to illustrate the process based on the Microsoft process that's already in place. Not because we're holding this up as the perfected security response process, but because it is in place. I've got a lot of experience with it, so I can talk about it. And by and large, we've had pretty good results so far. I'll start off with just a quick why and where. Drill down into what our response process looks like, just as a model. And then talk a little bit about some considerations that some of the second tier effects, some of the second tier questions that you need to keep in mind when you're designing a security response process. And then finally, we'll do a wrap up. I'm going to leave about 15 minutes for questions, so I figured there would probably be at least one. So I'm softening them up now, and then we'll be ready. All right, what's a security response process? Process for discovering security vulnerabilities in your products, for correcting them, for getting the information out to your customers so that they can protect themselves, and then finally, the part that's often overlooked, the process of taking feedback from those vulnerabilities forward into your onward products and improving the product quality as you go. There are some very strong advantages in having a security response process, if you're selling a software product of any kind where security is important, it's probably important for you to have some kind of a process for responding to reported vulnerabilities. The first advantage that you get from having a process like this is that it's a product differentiator, sets you apart from your competitors. The second thing is that it allows you to respond in an appropriate time frame. Way, way long time ago, 2, 3 years, 4 years ago, it wasn't quite as necessary to respond immediately to reported security vulnerabilities. Why? Well, first of all, the attacker's ability to reach out and touch your network was a little bit less than it is today. There weren't quite so many prepackaged kits out there that that people can use to attack your systems. Pardon me. And as a result, it was acceptable, and it even made sense to deliver security fixes as part of the next rollout of your product, the next upgrade, the next service pack, whatever. You can't do that today. Within a few hours of people discovering a vulnerability, there's going to be a hacker tool sitting out someplace that people can grab and can use to attack your networks. They don't have to be able to lay hands on your networks anymore to attack them. As a result, it's not acceptable to wait for the next service pack. If this is an important security vulnerability, you have to be able to respond immediately and let your customers protect themselves. And then finally, the last reason that you may want to put something like this into place is so that you can find out what's on your customers' minds. Are buffer overruns the things that people are worried about? Maybe, maybe not. Where is it in the grand scheme of things? How many people are worried about things like, say, a GUI that doesn't let them administer a product effectively? Where does that sit on the scale as opposed to, say, true security vulnerabilities? The only way to find out is to get feedback from your customers. Okay, looking at the response process that we use at Microsoft, let me tell you a little bit about where I fit into it. Our primary input for this process is a mailbox called secure@microsoft.com, and I field all of the questions that come in there. I work with the development teams to develop the patches. I write the security bulletins and publish them. Sitting in the center, if we're going to look at who does what, sitting in the center of our process is a security team, which I'm a part of. We're responsible for all product security in all Microsoft products across the board from end to end. You can guess that we're probably not substantive experts in every one of those areas. And as a result, we work pretty closely with all of the product teams. So George and Richie sitting back there about midway, the IE security guys, when we have an IE security problem, as soon as it's been determined that it's a real security problem, these are the guys that we rely on to verify that it really is a security vulnerability and to build the patch. Now, looking at this from a data flow perspective, let's take a look at who does what, which tasks we're going to do, and who's going to own them. The security team owns the discovery of the vulnerability reports, and we get that in four primary places. First one is secure@microsoft.com. That's probably the best place to report a security vulnerability. But we also get input from our product support folks. If somebody calls into PSS and is having a problem with a product and the tech learns in the process of troubleshooting that there's a problem with the product and it's a security vulnerability, they know to feed it to secure@microsoft.com. We also spend a lot of time trolling the mailing lists. NT BugTrack, BugTrack, of course, are the 800-pound gorillas out there. But there are a number of other mailing lists that are worth looking at. And we also spend a fair amount of time looking at the security websites. So not only the security focus sites of the world, the NT BugTrack website, we also take a look at the hacker sites. We try to do a scan of as many different sources of information on potential vulnerabilities as possible. So we get a vulnerability report. Somebody says they've just found a way to break into Internet Explorer. The first thing that happens is the security team does an initial triage, because we can cull at least 75% of the reports that come in. A good 75% of what initially comes into the system turns out not to be a security vulnerability after all. It's any of a number of other issues, some of which may require some action, but about three quarters fall out as security vulnerabilities. But let's take the 25% that we triage and we say, yeah, this might be a security vulnerability. At that point, we bring the product team in. The product team, every product team has got security program managers. We go to the security program managers and we say, okay, this passes the initial sniff test. Can you do a detailed repro? Let me know whether this thing is really a security vulnerability or not. Roughly 24 out of the 25% that make it to this repro stage are called out. But let's take a case, let's take that 1% that's not called out. It's a bona fide security vulnerability, okay? The product team's security specialists are going to send back and say, yeah, this is a bona fide security vulnerability. We need to fix it. They'll work on either a patch or a workaround. In some cases, it's more appropriate to do an administrative workaround than it is to do a patch. In some cases, we have to do both because of time constraints. Then we go into a testing phase. Now, while these activities are happening on the product side, the security team is developing the documentation that's going to accompany the fix when it's released. And there are three primary products we're going to produce there. The first one is a security bulletin. Has everybody seen a security bulletin from us? Is there anybody who hasn't? Oh, my. I don't know if that's good or bad. every patch that we put out, every workaround that we put out, every vulnerability that we discuss is going to be accompanied by a security bulletin. The security bulletin is going to say, what's the product that's affected? What's the risk of the vulnerability, and what can you do about it? Patch, workaround, whatever. A slightly more technical bit of documentation is going to be the knowledge base article. Every security bulletin is going to have a knowledge base article that accompanies it. And then there's going to be a third piece of documentation, the Premier Customer Alert, which largely mirrors the security bulletin and is sent out to Premier customers to ensure that they get a heads up as soon as we release a patch. Now, at some point, all of these things come together. We've got a tested patch. We've got finished documentation. We're ready to release. At this point, we distribute the fix and the information, and we're going to go out to a number of different avenues there. We're going to basically mirror the inputs that we had into this process. We're going to go out to our security website, www.microsoft.com/security. We're also going to mail out the bulletin to anybody who subscribes to our security notification list. It's just a list server, but anybody who wants to get the bulletins automatically can get them through that vehicle. And then we're going to go back out to the mailing lists and advise that that a patch is available, put the bulletin out so that they can distribute it to their readership. The last part, the part everybody always forgets, is the part where we're going to take what we've learned here and we're going to feed it back into our development process. What do we do in the next version of our product to make sure that we don't have the same problem again? Is it an overarching coding practice issue? If it is, then we need to start putting that into our best practices templates. We need to start testing for it in our future products. This is what allows us to hopefully have to fix fewer and fewer bugs over time. There are some tangible results that come from this process. This process has been in place at Microsoft for about 2 years. I can give you some numbers. During that time, we have received roughly 10,000 emails at secure@microsoft.com. I've been answering that mailbox the primary answerer for the past 9 months, roughly, and I've probably answered 3,000 to 4,000 emails during that time. Everybody who sends in to secure@microsoft.com will get an answer. May not be the answer they want, but they'll get an answer. Out of those 10,000 emails that came in, and out of those myriad postings up on the mailing list, we've done 72 security bulletins since the time that we established the process. The product notification service, this mailing service, we've got about 100,000 subscribers. Anybody who says that there's no interest out there in security needs to take a look at the subscribership of this mailing list. When we set this thing up about a year ago, we thought we budgeted for 15, maybe 20,000 subscribers, and we said we're going to have money to spare at the end of the year. We were up to 15,000 subscribers inside of 2 days. We were up to 25,000 subscribers inside of a week. We didn't know if this thing was ever going to level off. It finally leveled off at about 100,000 subscribers. www.microsoft.com/security is one of the more heavily visited sites on on the Microsoft website, and we know in talking with folks who go there that the primary driver is the security bulletins. So again, anybody who says that there's not an interest in product security, I think we've got numbers to the contrary. Those are the numbers. That's not the main reason we're doing this process. The main reason we're doing it is for the intangibles. The first one is better security for our customers. I mean, the bottom line has got to be, what are you doing for your customers? It's going to give them greater confidence in deploying Microsoft software if they understand that we're going to support the products and that we're going to develop patches whenever security vulnerabilities are found and that we're going to use what we learn to make our products better in the future. We've gotten a positive response from analysts and press. Gartner Group last year upgraded us from, I don't even want to discuss what our grade the year before was in security, but we were up to, I think, a B or a B plus overall this year. So we've actually gotten a pretty positive response. We've improved the quality of our code. A good example of how this happens sometimes is a recent buffer overrun issue that I think everybody has pretty well beat to death here over the past couple of days. About midway through the press flaying that we were taking over that, we started seeing emails from vice presidents coming down to the various development teams saying, "I'm not going to ask you how we're never going to see this happen again. I just want to assert that we are never going to see this happen again." This is not a free process, though. 10,000 incoming mails to secure@microsoft.com for roughly 70 some odd security bulletins. That's a lot of chaff for very little wheat. But the nuggets that you get are important enough that you still have to go through all the chaff. This is a really expensive process. Now, that $100,000 figure up there, I need to caveat that. That is a very back of the envelope estimate. It varies wildly from product to product, from bulletin to or from vulnerability to vulnerability. But we've estimated that in time, money, and other resources, it's about $100,000 to put one of these things out. Multiply 72 by $100,000 a pop, and you start to, you know, pretty soon you start to get into some serious money. The people who we need to do the reproing and the development of the patches are the people who we can least afford to detach from the development of ongoing products. They're the people who know the products inside and out. They're the people who understand security. They're highly specialized people, and it hurts to have to pull them off of ongoing development in order to patch a product that's already been shipped. Diverts resources from new development, and it pulls away people who we'd like to be able to focus on other things. One of the more painful parts of having a process in place like this is the feeding frenzy that it engenders. I've noticed over the past couple of days that there's been a number of speeches people have given where they're talking about security vulnerabilities in Microsoft products, and they're all referring to our bulletins and our patches. We're feeding ammunition to people who can take that information and spin it as a negative. It also has become increasingly lucrative for security companies to prove their bona fides by finding a security vulnerability in one of our products and getting credited for it in the security bulletin. All of this tends to, if you remember Economics 101, they told you that if you don't want something, you should tax it, and if you do want something, you should subsidize it. We are essentially subsidizing the discovery and publication of security vulnerabilities in our products, and so not surprisingly, we're getting a lot more of them reported because it's something that that pays off for people to look at. There's also an interesting phenomenon here going on that we've called bug fads, which is that you'll see, for instance, if there's a bulletin put out on, say, IIS, let's say, because IIS has had, we've had a couple of bulletins lately on IIS. You'll suddenly see a lot of attention being paid to IIS in the mailing lists, on the bulletin boards, coming into securemicrosoft.com, everybody suddenly starts looking at IIS and pounding away at it. That'll go on for a month or so, and then somebody will find something in another product, and then we'll all turn and we'll just flay the heck out of that product for a little while. So if you want a little fun sometime, take a look at the bulletins and watch the trends, watch the bulletins shifting from one product to another as people get bored with looking at one thing and go look at something else. Okay. Now, the really fun part of the talk here is to talk about those second-tier issues. This is all pretty easy to set up. You talk about, I'm going to have a mailbox for people to send in. We're going to develop patches and so on. Once you start trying to actually do it, you hit these second-tier questions of execution. And all of a sudden, you find out that this is not nearly as straightforward a process as it seems like it ought to be. For instance, what's a security vulnerability? How do you differentiate it from customer support? Somebody calls in and says that if they stand on their head and hit three keys in Outlook, that they can suddenly become an administrator or something like that. Is this something is this really a product support issue? This particular example, probably not. But how do you know that they're not just using how do you know that they haven't set it up incorrectly, that they haven't, how do you differentiate true security vulnerabilities from faulty setups? I leave your administrator password blank and you've got a fairly insecure system. Is that a security vulnerability or is that just cockpit error? User behavior. Is a Trojan horse a security vulnerability in one of our products? That's an open question. We can put up all the messages that we want that say you're about to run an executable from an untrusted source. It could contain a virus. Do you want to go ahead and do this? If the user answers yes and something bad happens to them, is that a security vulnerability in our product? Interesting question. Broken functionality. We recently repaired a case of just simple broken functionality in the RAS dial-in client. There was a great deal of discussion about whether that was a security vulnerability or whether it was just broken functionality that we should repair as any other functionality at the next service pack. If it wasn't exposing data, if it wasn't offering somebody the opportunity to take control of a machine, should we roll that out as part of the next service pack or do it as a security bulletin? Finally, what happens if you find a buffer overrun that's way down deep in the bowels of NT and nobody can get to it? It's not exploitable. Is that a security vulnerability? It certainly is bad coding practice, but is it worth doing a patch over? Is it worth asking your system administrators to go out and apply that patch to all of their machines if there's no way, as far as anybody can tell, that that thing can be exploited? Where we come down on it is this. We say that if a user uses the product correctly and they can be harmed, and the ability to harm them is out of their control, that constitutes a security vulnerability. That last part is kind of an important phrase. We've had long discussions with people about whether denial of service attacks from a website against a browser, whether that's a security vulnerability. And eventually we decided that it was not, because you can always kill the browser and not go back to that website anymore. As long as that website can't reach out and grab me, the only way I can be attacked is if I submit to being attacked. Now, that's a different issue if there's a loss of control, if there's a loss of data. But if it's just a simple denial of service, is that a security vulnerability? Are you going to guarantee a response time? I would love to be able to tell everybody that I'm going to have a patch out within 24 hours of notification of any security vulnerability. In truth, some things are harder than others. Particularly when you start looking at how long you're going to have to test something. All we can do is guarantee that we will take security vulnerability reports seriously, that we will act on them as fast as we can, that we will keep the reporter in the loop. That's about all we can guarantee. If I say that I'm going to have a patch out in 2 days, and it's three, suddenly somebody thinks that I've dropped the ball. 3 days may still be plenty responsive. Are you going to give a guarantee that you'll respond to every report of any security vulnerability in any of your products? Well, the upside to that is that it doesn't leave those hanging allegations. If you ever read, for instance, NT Bug Track, somebody will pop up and they'll say, I've just discovered the most massive, humongous, epoch-shattering, network-destroying hole in Windows NT that has ever been discovered. And you'll never hear anything more on it. And the answer is, well, because a bunch of people probably send him notes. I've seen some of these happen. People send him notes privately and say, excuse me, you left the administrator password blank. That guy's not going to go back up to NT Bug Track and say, I'm sorry, I left the administrator password blank. And nobody else is going to go up and say that either, because you don't want to kind of face the person who made that posting. But that allegation is now hanging out there. If this is one of your products, are you now going to post a note out there that says, attention everybody, his administrator password was blank, this is not really a security vulnerability? In some ways it's good, because it doesn't leave that impression that there are security vulnerabilities where there aren't. On the other hand, you want to talk about a way to increase the amount of work required by an order of magnitude and turn yourself into the world's product support person. That's the way to do it. I would love to be able to answer every note that shows up on BugTrack and NT-BugTrack, but we just don't have the resources to do that. So where we have come down is that we will answer every note that comes into us at secure@microsoft.com. Any discussion on a mailing list that passes the initial triage, we'll try to take it offline with the customer so that we can go back and forth and have a good discussion with them about what exactly did you do, how did you set up your product, can you give me some repro circumstances, and so on. But we'll take those discussions offline, and we leave it to the poster to follow back up with the mailing lists. Is that the best way to do it? I don't know. Everybody's favorite topic of late, how much detail are you going to publish when you put your security bulletin out? We believe in full disclosure, but I have to define it, because there's a difference in what full disclosure means depending on what your objective is. Our objective in putting those bulletins out is to get every customer who needs the patch to apply the patch. That's what I want to do. I'm not looking at this as a science project to expand the scope of human knowledge. Full disclosure, given the objectives that I have, consists of telling the customer whether they're affected, how they're affected, the risk this poses to them, and what they can do about it to protect themselves. What I'm not in the business of doing is providing full exposure. I'm not in the business of telling everybody in the world, hey, here's how you can knock down somebody's server if they haven't applied the patch. I'm not about providing recipes for people to use to attack other people. Take a real life situation. If my neighbor is leaving his back door open, it makes perfect sense for me to go over and knock on his door and say, Joe, you know your back door is open. Somebody could rob you blind. But if I take it upon myself to go rob him in the middle of the night, take all of his stuff, haul it out, sell it, and then leave a note on his door that says, now this will teach you about the importance of security. In real life, I go to jail if I do that kind of thing. We draw the same distinction in terms of how much we disclose. We don't want to provide hacking tools. We don't want to help people who are simply being malicious. We do want to allow people to know whether they are affected and what they should do about it. Okay, when do you publish the information? We've had folks who have said that we should always publish some kind of a heads up to our customers the minute we know that there's some kind of a vulnerability, even if it's only to tell them that we are working on the patch. The alternative is to delay public discussion of a vulnerability until you can protect your customers. And that really is that's the direction that we take. What we do is, what we would like to do in the best case is we'd like to roll out a bulletin and a patch all at the same time, let the world learn about the vulnerability at the same time that system administrators can protect themselves against it, not give anybody advance notice. Now what we'll do in the meantime, because sometimes these secrets do get out, is we'll monitor the mailing list, we'll monitor the websites, we'll look for any sign that this issue has gone public, and if it's gone public, then obviously we've got to go public too. But if we can, we would very much prefer to be able to roll everything out together at one time, not have anybody wasting any sleep. Did I see a hand up there at one point? Okay, are you going to give advance notice to selected groups? There are folks who I would love to be able to give advance notice to. I'd love to be able to tell CERT a day before I'm going to go live with a patch that the patch is coming. I'd like to be able to tell the security ISVs about it. I'd also like to be able to tell our premier customers that tomorrow we're going to release a bulletin and you should get ready for it. It would be great to be able to do that. But that presupposes a sufficiently small level of chaos, which simply does not exist. These things are, as one person has described it, these things are like giving birth to a watermelon. Trying to get all of the documentation together, trying to get the patch together, trying to get the testing finished up, trying to get it all together at one time and now get it out to all the right places, the bulletin, the list server, the mailing lists, all at the same time simultaneously so that the curtain comes up and the whole thing is there done. That is a really hard thing to do. And unfortunately, the only way that we could provide advance notice to selected groups of customers would be by delaying what the general population learns, and we just can't do that. So what we do is we alert everybody as soon as we can, but we do provide direct channels for, say, premier customers. How much testing are you going to do on the patches? Perfect world, I would do full regression testing on every patch. Absolutely. Make it production quality, make it as good as you can. On the other hand, I'm usually fighting the clock. We've only got a certain amount of time before these issues become public, and I've got to have a patch. There's no right and wrong level of testing for any particular product. It varies from product to product and vulnerability to vulnerability. A patch is going to be applied to, say, Windows NT. Just because of the millions of customers who are using Windows NT, the thousands of different platforms they're running it on, the millions of applications it's going to have to interact with, I've got an application compatibility issue here that demands that I do an awful lot of regression testing. Now, if it's a security vulnerability in Microsoft Golf, I may let that one slide with quite a bit less testing. So on a case-by-case basis, we determine what the right level of testing is given the product that's involved and the part of the product that's affected by the vulnerability. We then take all of the patches that we develop between service packs, and we do a roll-up into each service pack. All of the patches that are put into the service packs undergo full regression testing as part of the service pack testing. Okay, so wrapping all of this up. The first thing that I have to point out is that this is not a trivial effort. This is not something that if you're a company who's developing software and thinking that this is a that this is something that you would like to potentially implement, this is not something to be entered into lightly. Very labor intensive. You're never going to know when you win. If I produce 100 bulletins this year, have I done a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. If I only produce one, have I done a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. The answer is I need to produce the right number of bulletins. I need to produce a bulletin for every vulnerability that deserved it. The benefits that you get are mostly intangible. And this can be a painful, painful, painful process because I'm doing nothing but feeding bad press reporting. I am my competitor's best friend. If I don't get Christmas cards from every one of our competitors, I'm going to feel hurt. The intangibles, though, are what makes this worth doing. The first one is, if you're a customer-focused company, you got to protect your customers. That's just all there is to it. This is a really good way of building trust with your customers. I've even gotten some good email at secure@microsoft.com from some system administrators at some of our large companies who have said, you know, thank you for the patch that saved us. So sometimes you do get kudos. Sometimes you even get it in the press, but don't count on it. Better relationship with your customers. And the last point is an important one. You can roll out a security response process at whatever level of effort you're able to sustain, and you can derive good benefit from it. It's not necessary to have the end-all and be-all in terms of a security response process in order to get some benefit from it. We've rolled out as much as we can support right now, but we've got some really definite plans about where we want to go with it to try to do things like have enough control over the process so that we can provide advance notice to certain groups of customers and to the incident response teams and so on. We'd like to be able to respond at least selectively to some of the postings in the mailing list. There are places we'd like to push this process out a little bit further, but you can get good benefit from whatever level you decide to implement. Okay, and with that, I have strapped on my Kevlar underwear. And if anybody wants to take a shot at me, go right ahead.
Yeah, you made a distinction between the patches and the workaround. Do you have examples of when you call one a patch and one a workaround?
Okay. Question was, what's the difference between a patch and a workaround? A patch is a piece of software that you apply that corrects the behavior, the underlying behavior of the vulnerability that caused it. A workaround is an administrative series of steps. Good example of where we'll go out with a workaround is usually if it's time constrained. For instance, we had a recent IIS issue that was suddenly sprung on the world. And just to give you a little bit of background on what happened in that case, we had a patch completed by the time that one went public, but we had discovered additional variants of that same vulnerability. And so we had gone back and pulled the original patch out of testing, had developed a comprehensive patch, and had put that into testing. But it wasn't out of testing yet when this issue suddenly went public. So we had to do something to let people protect themselves during the 2 days in which we were waiting for testing to be completed. And so what we did was we went out with a series of steps. You know, open this menu, select this option, turn this thing off, and then when the patch was available, we went back out and said, okay, you can turn all of it back on again if you want to apply the patch, or if you want to leave the workaround in place, you can leave it in place.
I have several.
Okay.
You started off by saying that you responded to what people worry about, and it seems to me that as a security person, the last thing in the world we should be thinking about is what has people's attention. That's a lousy metric to use for prioritizing security problems, because the worst problems are very likely to be the ones that haven't hit people's radar screen. And nobody's worried about them. And if they come through, it's it's bad. So if you're looking at the kinds of responses that you're getting from the outside world, if you're looking, well, people aren't really worried about this vulnerability in the macro capabilities of Word or this IIS feature, so we're going to put this down the queue. I think that's a very bad strategy in terms of establishing your priorities.
Okay, the question was whether the appropriate metric is what we know to the vulnerabilities that we know of versus the vulnerabilities that customers are concerned with.
So, instead of, it's not what worry your customers. Mm-hmm. Your customers are kind of behind the curve. Mm-hmm. You should hopefully be ahead of the curve because you're actively, aggressively looking for problems, not just responding to people's concerns.
Well, first thing is that we are the security response process. So I am supposed to be, I am the reactive process. There's a proactive process that is also going on in product development to try to provide stronger security features in products and so on. So the forward-looking end of this is happening. It's just not happening by me because I'm on the reactive team. But we do repair vulnerabilities when we find them, even if they're only internal finds. For instance, we just released last week, we backported a patch out of SP5 to make it available to people who were locked down on SP4 for Y2K purposes. This was an internal find. Nobody else in the world even knew that vulnerability existed. We discovered it. I'm not sure how we discovered it. I just don't recall. But we discovered it internally. It had never gone public. It was something that was clearly a security vulnerability, and so we patched it. So it's not driven solely by how loud is somebody yelling. We try to do the right thing, even if it's even if we're the only ones who know about it.
So your initial comment at the beginning of the talk is not exactly
true. I think it is. One of the benefits is.
Okay. Can you read some of the dialogue? I'm going to get one side back here. Come up closer then.
Yeah,
the
dialogue is largely over whether it's more appropriate to focus on the reports versus going out and finding them ourselves or patching the ones that we learn of ourselves. Is it?
Well, it's just that you put it in the context of triage, that you establish your triage mechanism by the concern that you experience in the user base.
And Okay, I hope I didn't leave that impression. We do not triage them based on how loud somebody is yelling. When something is reported, when we learn about it by any means, we triage it. We triage them all the same. If it's a security vulnerability, we're going to patch it. Whether it was discovered on NTBugTrack, whether there's one note about it, whether there's 1,000 notes about it. If it's a security vulnerability, if we think it may be a security vulnerability, we're going to triage it. If we determine that it is a security vulnerability, we're going to patch it. Okay?
Can you give me a definition of what you mean by going public?
Okay, definition of.
If you use once against somebody, an attack vulnerability has been exploited, does that mean it's public?
Okay, question was. Okay. Question was, what's meant by going public? pardon me. There isn't a strict definition. Basically, if we find out about it, we consider it to be public. If it's been reported on a mailing list, it's public. It's difficult to say, difficult to give you a specific example or specific definition because, for instance, if this thing has been out on somebody's website, but nobody seems to know about it, if we find out about it, we're gonna triage it, we're gonna patch it, we're gonna put a bulletin out on it. Would we consider it to have already been public? Possibly not. If it's on a fairly infrequently traveled website and doesn't seem to be getting picked up anyplace else, we're probably going to treat that as a non-public issue until we see somebody else starting to pick it up. So we're going to take the time that we need to try to do the patch as well as we can. But if we start seeing that information spreading and going someplace else, we're going to say that it's now becoming a more public issue. So there's not a strict definition of what goes public. When we see it on one website, we're not going to assume that we have to, say, drop work on the patch and do a workaround, for instance. If it doesn't seem to be traveling, we're going to try and do the patch, because that's the preferred response. Okay, I'll come back around. Yeah, there's the question was over the definition of a vulnerability, specifically with respect to, the ability of, for instance, viruses to turn off future virus checking. That's an area that we're all going to be able to argue over, because it really is a judgment call. The reason that we've treated that as not a security vulnerability is because you've got the ability to, say, prevent executables from running. You've got the ability to, you've got the warning messages that come up, that will tell you that you're about to run something that could potentially be dangerous. Right, but it can only shut that off if you've allowed executables to run. You have to have made the mistake once. In order to get bitten by it a second time. I'm not by any means disputing that this is something that we need to do, that we need to improve the product in. We certainly do. And actually, I know the outlook. What's that?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. That's an area that the office folks are. They understand there is significant scrutiny on that particular point, and they're spending a lot of time trying to figure out what the best answer is. The problem, though, is that we do live in a world of engineering trade-offs, and there are an awful lot of customers who would be awfully upset with us if we remove the ability to, if we remove the strength of the scripting, because there are an awful lot of folks out there who are relying on the fact that they can do an awful lot of things through VBScript. So we can. We can turn one side off and turn the other side on. There's a balance point somewhere in between, and like everybody else, we're struggling to find out where that balance point is.
That's actually the center of my next thing. And what you're saying now concerns me greatly. Because there are things that embedding VBA in the office cause that can in fact bypass even the ability that I don't need to make the first error. That there are ways of preventing the word macro virus checking from ever occurring within the document. Now this is a little more deeper right now, but if you came to the point where security or an issue like this would require you to reduce or remove functionality from the product, who's in charge here?
Okay, question is, when it comes down to a question of functionality versus security, who's going to drive? We are going to try to come up with the answer that this is going to be kind of a weasel answer, but it's the truth. In the end, the customer is going to decide.
The customer doesn't have this choice. There must be something in the air in Redmond that causes you to think about the way computing occurs in the real world that thinks that everybody is in charge of their systems at this high level of consciousness. It just isn't true. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of small companies out there that are just barely administering their systems. And what you've done is you've put high-powered explosives into every box. And you said, now be very careful opening this box because it could blow up and you need an explosives expert. And if you have an explosives expert on site, you're fine.
Well, that's not quite true. What we're doing is we're providing...
What do you do about the user double clicks on executable? Well, I mean, if you can get the user to double click on the wrong executable, then you can cause a lot of bad things to happen, right?
What? I'm just, yeah.
Okay, so how's that any really different than getting them to run the water back up? Is it really the same problem?
See, I just thought these things that by bringing up the dialogue box, saying this program may contain the harmful codes, I now am now responsible for my life. Okay, but that's...
Well, but there's more than that. You can disable say the ability to run script. You can turn off a number of those features. That's the direction we're heading, is to give you warnings before something potentially dangerous happens, to allow you to configure what can and can't happen on your machine. And what that's going to do is it's going to push up the complexity. And so the other thing that we are trying to do is to try to manage the complexity through smart software, through wizards and things like that. But this is a trade-off that there is no right answer. The right answer for customers is not to put them into, is not to straitjacket them and say, I'm not going to let you do this because this is just not good for you and you should not be allowed to do this. Every time I come up with a case like that, where I believe I should be able to sandbox somebody and not let them out of IT jail, somebody else can present a counter-argument that says just as strong about why there's a legitimate reason why somebody should want to do that, and if I'm not going to give them the ability to do that, they're going to go to somebody else who will. And now where is security? Because now we've driven customers to somebody who say isn't even going to give you the ability to configure those options. It's a trade-off. Yeah, way in the back. Sure.
How many engineers are employed by Microsoft today? Two-part question.
Oh, good. I have no idea.
I
have no idea. I couldn't even guess. Yeah, more than one. Yeah, they won't fit into a breadbasket. I know that.
Okay, in your assessment, how many trained security engineers are there in Microsoft?
Ah, now that one I can answer. How many trained security engineers in Microsoft?
And what is the level of their experience?
Okay. Do I have to keep that adjective in there? There are over 200 full-time employees at Microsoft whose sole job in life is to improve product security. In terms of level of training, I can't address that. It's going to vary from person to person. Some of it's on-the-job experience, some of it is going to be academic experience, and it's going to depend on where in the company they work. If you're working, say, in cryptographic research, I have a pretty good idea that you probably have got a PhD at the end of your name. If you're doing product security on say, another product, you may not have a PhD behind your name. Okay. Jack, did we? Yeah, back in the half. Okay. Question is, where on our priority list is security? I can tell you what a recent Computer World survey concluded, and that was that security was number two on our customers' lists. That mirrors what we've seen from our own internal market research. That's one reason why we're putting the emphasis on security that we are. That's one reason why you see, for instance, a security response process in place today that wasn't in place a couple of years ago. It's become more important to customers, so it's become more important to us. Did I see any?
Yeah. What sort of feedback processes do you have for conveying, I guess, the results of the trends that you see from your seat back into the development population?
Okay. How do we feed information from the response process back into the developer organizations? That's really a pretty easy one because remember that the product teams are developing the patches. So the folks who need to have the information have got it right there because they're the folks who are having to put up with the pain, who are having to develop the products and are getting to see firsthand what the issues are. Now the other thing that happens from the security team is that we take information that we've generated, kind of looking over the broad landscape. We can pull up issues that occur across product lines. And we can push that up to upper management, and it actually works pretty well. We get pretty good feedback from the product teams, and we get pretty good responses from the senior executives when we start bringing up the fact that that this is something that is showing up across more than one product line. We usually get pretty good results. feeding that information back down to the product teams in terms of best practices. Yeah, Adam. Okay, the statement was that we're using the word full disclosure incorrectly, and the I guess you're just looking for a response then, right? Okay. Remember that our objective is probably different from that of the rest of the security community. Remember that my objective is not to increase the scope of human knowledge. My objective is to get every customer who ought to pick up that patch to pick that patch up and apply it. With that difference in objectives, that's why I refer to what we do in our context, that is fully disclosing all the information that ought to be disclosed. To provide more information than that, to provide hacking tools and step-by-step instructions and so on and so forth, that does nothing for the customer. It doesn't encourage them to pick up the patch where they otherwise would have. It doesn't let them assess the risk any better than the information that they previously had. The only thing it does is it allows third parties to use that information against them. And we simply feel that that's irresponsible, and that's why we don't do it. Okay, come here.
Just as an academic question here, in the event, say, you receive two security vulnerability reports, both proved to be true. One regards a remote attack, another is a local unauthorized elevation of privileges. Which would take top priority?
Wow. You're asking me to choose between the relative importance of, say, a remote attack or a local elevation of privileges?
Yes, two proven. They've both been triaged, shown to be accurate. One is a remote attack, another is a local attack. Which one would your team view as the top priority?
It really would depend on the specifics, because it's going to depend on, you know, does one strike domain controllers?
They both have the same consequences.
I can only give you a hypothetical answer to a hypothetical question. It really would depend on the specifics. I have never seen a case where I've gotten two vulnerability reports in at the same time that required that much, you know, that were that finely similar in terms of their importance. If it comes in, you know, we would simply, I mean, that's what triaging is all about. Triaging is about sorting and prioritizing. And we would simply have to make a decision and prioritize one above the other, even if only by a small delta. I just can't answer that one, sorry. Who else have we got? Yes, sir. Did everyone hear that one? I'm not sure that I can paraphrase it. Was there anybody who didn't hear? I think you've got a valid point. I'm not by any means suggesting that that we shouldn't treat security vulnerabilities seriously. That we shouldn't be the size of the product isn't really an excuse for having vulnerabilities in it. I mean, none of this relieves us of our obligation to provide the highest quality product that we can, and we're really serious about doing that. You're right, though, in that anything that's been devised by the hand of man is going to be imperfect, and unfortunately, that involves software from all vendors, including Microsoft. I can't guarantee that we're going to produce perfect products. I don't even want to promise that we're going to produce perfect products. What I can promise is that we will respond to reports of vulnerabilities in them as expeditiously as possible, and we'll be as forthcoming as we can be with information on the availability of the patch, what customers ought to do, and so on. Yeah.
Behind you.
Question was about Easter eggs. How do we know that there are no Easter eggs? There was also a statement about the number of lines of code in the product. And let me jump on that one real quickly, because I keep hearing this number tossed around. There is nobody who can tell you authoritatively the number of lines of code in Windows NT, because we don't give that information out. Anybody who's telling you that it's 25 million lines or 50 million lines or whatever is talking out the top of their hat, because we don't publish that information, because it's a counting question. A number of the things that used to be separate shrink-wrapped entities are now part of the operating system, but are separate coding entities nonetheless. What do you count as part of Windows 2000? What I can tell you is that the size of the kernel has not changed significantly in Windows 2000. The size of the Windows 2000 kernel is not significantly larger than it was in NT4. Now, as to the question, excuse me. I'm sorry, hit me with the second question again. Easter eggs. I can't stand up here and tell you that there is no hidden code in any of our products. What I can tell you is the email that I've seen coming down from Jim Alchin, the vice president who's in charge of Windows NT development. Quoting as nearly as I can, I think it said, if you drop an Easter egg into my product, you might as well head out the door now rather than having me escort you. This is not something that we're interested in doing. This isn't something we're tolerating. There's peer code review at every stage in the development process. So there's no way that one person is going to drop some piece of untrusted code into one of our products and it not be discovered. The peer code review process is going to point that out. You're going to have to hand it off to testers who are going to be checking, you're going to be running through their test suites. It's going to come up that way. This is something that we're pretty hardcore about not doing, because it sends the wrong message when you leave Easter eggs in the products, and we're simply not doing it anymore. Yeah, question.
I realize this is a hot topic. If you have some more questions, Scott will be available to answer after this session. At 1440, we'll start up again with Patrick Peterson. Thank you.